Paratopia, welcome yet again to another exciting edition of Jeff Ritzman.
Paratopia.
That's right. Hey, Jeff, how you doing?
Hello.
You're my co-host.
I'm bleeding.
And I'm your co-host.
I'm bleeding. I'm bleeding.
I don't know what that means. Are you really bleeding?
Yes, yes. I ran my finger into a door jamb today, and I made a significant cut on my knuckle, and it's running down my arm.
Would you like to get a Band-Aid or perhaps a stitch for that before we
go? No, I've got a Band-Aid on it. It seems to have stopped. I think I'll be all right.
Is the blood dried?
Well, it's escaping from underneath the pad, so I don't know. This could be bad. Hmm. I'll get another Band-Aid. I have some C-3PO Band-Aids in my medicine cabinet. Did I say that out loud?
Tonight's guest is Dr. Cynthia Andrews. Colin Andrews' wife.
Ah.
Yeah. But she's also her own woman, as it turns out, and a doctor. And she has a book called The Path of Energy. But basically, what I wanted to talk to her about was... you know, we always hear these sort of New Agey terms or Eastern terms like chakra or, you know, we were talking about astral travel on the last show. So I kind of wanted somebody to come on and just actually define these things and tell us
can
how
you
they
give me
intersect. What?
I'm sorry. Can you give me a minute? Because I am bleeding.
Yes, go.
Thanks.
If you record audio for any purpose, chances are you want it to be heard. You want to attract the largest audience possible who can hear your message. That's where we come in. We're CyberEars.com, a revolutionary internet service that will host your audio files and help you promote and track its popularity. Considering hosting a podcast to the world? We have all the automated tools to make the process as simple and easy as it can be. No technical mumbo-jumbo to work out. CyberEars.com does all the work for you. You record it, we take care of the rest. So don't delay. Go to CyberEars.com today and register for a free trial account. Upload your audio files and get heard. With CyberEars.com, it's your audio on your terms.
Hey, Paratopia. In the setup to my interview with Dr. Cynthia Andrews, I talk about one of her websites. And at the end of the show, she talks about another website. And that other website is thepathofenergy.com. So that's where you can go to learn all about her book, The Path of Energy, Awaken Your Personal Power and Expand Your Consciousness. You can also read some energy meditations, sign up for some courses, all of that fun stuff. The reason I'm telling you this is because the other website that I'm about to mention with Jeff here has a bio of her that I read from extensively, and so I don't want to take that portion of this out. But I would just like you to be aware right up front here that there are two websites, the one I'm about to mention with Jeff and thepathofenergy.com. All right. Time back in.
Hello?
Yes! How is it?
It's bleeding through the Band-Aid, but it's fine.
Cell anemia? It's a bitch.
No. No, I don't think so. Just a very big gash off the top of my skin. So.
Yeah. Well, I hope if you start to feel woozy and you start to lose consciousness, just, you know, let me know and I'll...
No, it's...
I'll be sure to record that.
It's about... It's about the size of the head of a pin, actually. I think I'll be okay.
Very good. Well, as I was saying, Jeff, before I was rudely interrupted by your imminent death.
Yes.
So we talk about all these things and astral projection and so on and so forth. And I want to not only define what these things are, what is a chakra, what is the aura, what is the ether, what is this energy that we talk about, but then how also are they interlinked, interconnected? What do they mean? Why aren't they detectable by science? You know, all those fun questions. And so thankfully, she was able to answer them. Now, what I'm a little disappointed by is I had said on the forum that I was going to tell a story about when the Kogi were in New York recently that sort of tied together a bunch of themes lately. one of which is your question about whether or not objects actually do have some sort of existence in some astral realm or, you know, something along those lines.
Uh-huh.
But my friend Melissa, who's actually the, you know, lived it, it's her story, said that she would rather come on the show and talk about it because she thinks it would be more powerful and appropriate that way to sort of tell her story. So in honoring her wish, I will not tell the Kogi story. I like them apples.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'd just like to postulate my other theory briefly in 30 seconds or less, which is that all inanimate objects are actually alive and conspiring against us. Thank you.
Terrence would be proud.
That's right.
So I guess it would behoove us, before we introduce one Cynthia Andrews, to promote her website, which is andrewshealingarts.com. And this is kind of interesting because it says here in her bio, Cynthia Andrews has been in the world of holistic health for over 25 years. Her work is focused on the relief of pain and the resolution of underlying mechanical, metabolic, emotional, and or traumatic causes. She has recently expanded her scope of practice to include naturopathic medicine to assist people in their quest for pain-free living. Cynthia maintains a private practice and teaches classes and workshops. She was a faculty member at the Connecticut Center for Massage Therapy from 1991 to 2005. She's co-authored 3 books and contributes to journal articles. She currently teaches workshops at the Kripalu Yoga Institute and is an authorized teacher of the Jin Shin Do Foundation. So, essentially, Dr. Andrews is a healer with a private practice and teaches workshops and all that fun stuff, and you can sign up for some of that stuff at her website, andrewshealingarts.com. You can read all about her and all about her work. And this is an interesting interview. I got a little note from her afterwards saying, thanks for the interview, it was great, and it was not the typical interview that she's used to. And so if she missed any nuance, her apologies. But I don't know that she did miss a whole lot of nuance. Unfortunately, what she did miss was Jeff Ritzman.
Yes.
Who's nowhere to be found in this interview.
Right, because Jeremy didn't answer Skype.
Well, to be fair, I didn't see you on there.
Now, to be fair, I got your voicemail on Skype.
Well, it said that you were online, but when I tried to call, you weren't picking up the phone.
But to be fair, I left Jeremy a message.
Well, to be fair, I didn't get that message until well after the interview. Also, to be fair, your phone isn't working, so what should have happened is that you would call me.
That's true.
Like, hey, Jeremy, where are you?
But my phone is being upgraded, so therefore I'm incommunicado as far as a cell phone. But I hope you asked her about hemorrhoids.
Why would you hope that?
Well, because, Jeremy, you've told me about your problem, and I just...
Oh, Jeff, come on. That's how rumors get started.
Oh, no. No!
All right, without any sort of ado, I think that was enough.
It's
enough
too late.
Nothing. Yeah. Here is Dr. Cynthia Andrews. Paratopia, without further ado, here is the author of The Path of Energy. And the wife of, am I allowed to say that? Cynthia, well, the wife of Colin Andrews, Cynthia Andrews.
Yes, of course you're allowed to say it.
Oh, cool. Cynthia, thank you very much for doing the show. And really, I guess, thanks in advance for taking us through certain terms that you probably are so familiar with you don't even want to talk about.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. And, you know, the thing about the terms, I'm not sure which ones you're going to go for, but they're so, you know, everybody has their own definition, so they definitely do require going over.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just it. It's it just strikes me as we talk about, you know, chakras or energy, you know, the sort of stuff mm-hmm. that isn't proven by Western science. How do we get there? How do we get to something that isn't provable?
Well, it isn't that it's exactly not provable. I mean, if you stop and think about it, everything that we know about microwave energy, about radio waves, was at one time not provable by science, but we knew it was there because we could discern effects. And we can discern the effects of this subtle energy field as well. In fact, David Bohm, who's the grandfather or one of the grandfathers of quantum physics, has postulated that there has to be a fifth force, which he calls subtle energy, a subtle energy field that underlies electromagnetism and explains the whole class of phenomenon that are currently unexplained by the four known forces of physics. So if you know, the physicists like David Bohm are postulating the existence of this field, I think it won't be very long before there is some scientific verification of it being there. And then I think when they can develop the technology to measure it and to quantify it, we're going to have answers to things like telepathy and other paranormal phenomena that currently fall outside of the range of science.
When we talk about an energy field like that, are we talking about something that permeates us or something where beings could exist themselves in? I mean, what exactly would this energy field be?
I kind of think of it as the matrix, you know. So if David Bohm is talking about this as being a subtle energy field underlying electromagnetism, it really is the idea that it gives rise to physical substance. And if we look at Einstein's equation E equals mc squared, what we're saying is that there's a range between energy and matter, but they are the same stuff, just what rate are they vibrating at? And so if this fifth field is giving rise to everything within that whole spectrum of energy and matter, then it is the realm of other beings. It is the realm of this physical reality. It's the realm of other dimensions. It's kind of the substance of existence, how I see it anyway.
Well, one of the things that I... See, here's my problem in life, really, is that I would be laughing the stuff off and not paying it any mind if I didn't experience some of this. And
right.
One of the things I've experienced are chakras, because I have this sort of kundalini, I guess you would say, awakening or whatever. I've got this energy that moves the body and makes it do these sorts of exercises and ritualistic-looking things. And if, you know, all you need to do is take a glance at any book on chakras to know that a lot of what it's sort of slapping about with my hands are these, you know, in line with these energy centers that allegedly exist.
And, you know, I think you've just nailed it. You just nailed it, the whole thing. The idea is that our bodies are receptors for this energy, just in the same way that our eyes receive frequency in the spectrum of visual light and translate it into information in the brain, and the ears do that with auditory frequencies. Our body is receiving the frequencies of this subtle energy and translating it into information that has been known from culture to culture to culture across this planet from very, very ancient times. And it doesn't matter if you look at the Hindu description of chakras or the Chinese description of the, you know, energy centers or Native American descriptions. They are so coherent in what they're reflecting that to deny that they have gotten this information from their own bodies and reflected it back would be silly. I mean, kind of like denying ancient astronauts.
Well, so where did it go? I mean, where did this knowledge go as far as the Western mind is concerned?
Well, my theory is that we're always trying to develop different aspects of ourselves, and we became very engrossed, the Western mind, if you will, became very engrossed in developing the intellect, and we developed the intellect to the loss of some of our other senses. I think if you look at what we did with our intellect, we created almost a recreation, if you will, an externalization of what our bodies can do internally. I mean, we've created the World Wide Web. What is that but a metaphor for collective consciousness? We've created all different kinds of technological advances that just simply reflect back what we can do ourselves. And so I think that at this point, especially if we were to lose all of our technology with a silver flare or something dramatic like that, we would find ourselves relying back on the technology of our body, on what our bodies can actually do, see and feel and experience and inform us about.
Do you have any idea, since we're on the topic of chakras, ostensibly, why it is, like, for instance, you talk about a certain number, I think it's, is it seven chakras? But there are different chakra systems. I know I've read of, you know, allegedly more than that. So why did you settle on seven? How do you settle on a number?
The reason that I focus on those seven is because those are the seven that I call the physio-energetic centers. They're the chakras that are permeate our physical body and interact with our physiology. So if we looked at our entire energy field, if we looked at all the layers of this emanation that comes out of us, that is our expression in this energy realm, we have many different chakras within that energy expression, but there are seven of them. Well, there are hundreds of them that interact with the body, like in the hands of the feet, or the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet and joints in different places, but the seven through our torso are the ones that really guide development and are linked into our endocrine and neuro system in such a way that they are essential to our developing awareness as conscious spiritual beings. I think that once we, because they're physiologically wired, they're easier for us to perceive, and that once we've begun to perceive them and work with them, as you've described you are, it becomes much, much easier to then work with these more esoteric and etheric chakras that people report existing. So I'm not saying that these are the only ones. They're just the easiest ones to access.
So, all right, let's make this all about me for a second. if you've got a guy like me who, in a moment of getting it or whatever, has a moment of quiet, and in that moment of stillness where the brain is still, this other, seemingly other thing takes over, this other energy, you know, kundalini, whatever you want to call it, takes over and makes the body do yoga or tai chi or any number of things. Is that the natural state of a human being? If the Western mind didn't build us up logically, would we be that other, seemingly other entity?
Well, I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure that I can completely relate to your experience. It's not one that I've shared, so I'm just imagining it. But it seems to me that what you're describing is within yourself a split between what's more biologically organic and what's superimposed through your mind. And a lot of the mind and a lot of what the mind carries are conditionings and patterns and habits and expectations that we've been trained with since the time that we were born. And so I would say that this kundalini experience that you're having, in my experience of kundalini, what kundalini does is move the resistances out of our body from being that organic and authentic self. And as it does that, it brings up all the issues that are, you know, all the traumas that are have been submerged or hidden or not dealt with in our life, and kind of forces us to deal with them. And then as we deal with them, that sense of separation disappears. The mind and the body can become united in one force, in one thing. And so you're not necessarily that other being that you're describing, if I'm understanding you right. You're more of an amalgamation, a more of a wholeness that is your true self. If that makes any sense at all.
Yeah. I find it interesting that it's like ne'er the twain shall meet. It's like in order to activate this other energy, I have to step aside, and, you know, to stop it, so I have to come back. But I can't really be here and, you know, I can sort of sit in the background and watch it, but it's not like I can be active at the same time, I guess.
Well, so you're sort of describing surrender. And you're describing, you know, surrender to an experience. And what I would say is that that observing self is learning while you're having this experience, and that at some point you will be able to fully inhabit the experience on all levels, observing it and being in it, surrendering and initiating it. In fact, there's a great meditation in the book, The Path of Energy, that was given to me by one of my mentors, Louisa Poole, who is just this amazing woman in Rockport, Massachusetts. And it's called Dancing with the Elements, and it's this whole idea of surrendering to the energy coming at you from the elements and moving with that until you don't know whether you're responding to the wind pushing you or you're drawing the wind to you. It becomes an amazing experience of connection, which I think is what you're headed towards in what you're experiencing.
Okay, so what does our world look like then? What have we just said here, that there's this larger field of energy of which we are a part or in which we are embedded, whether we know it or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you come to know it, then can you come to utilize it?
Well, yeah, in the same way that we utilize microwaves and embed it with information and pick it up on cell phone technology, we will, when we understand this sea of energy that we live within, when we begin to realize the ways in which our body is decoding that information and giving us insights into the world, then yes, we absolutely can begin to use it, and we can begin to use it for a lot of different things in a lot of different ways, manifesting goals being one of them. Using it for telepathic communication being another, healing being even more. But the idea being that there are that this energy field exists with laws that are complete, just the same way that gravity does. And before we understood gravity, we were still beholden to those laws, the way that we are beholden to the laws of subtle energy. The more that we understand those laws, the more that we can begin to then utilize them for growth and development and conscious choices in the world, as opposed to just being driven by them. So I think that is, for me, that's the whole point of subtle energy, is to have, you know, or subtle energy awareness, is to have a better sense of connection to the world and to be fully functioning, a fully functioning human, so that we can be our creative, authentic self, in the biggest way we can.
So do you think it would be fair to say that we actually, or at least not I, but Native Americans or Chinese, the Hindus, you think that any of the people who have not forgotten this know more about it than we actually do about gravity? I mean, do you think that there are fully fleshed out systems that are authentic?
Yes.
That work repeatedly?
Yes. Yes, there certainly are. Whether they know more about them than we know about gravity, I wouldn't even begin to say that. But yes, there are very fully fleshed out systems that describe a very definite piece of reality. And then if we think of it like an ant looking at an elephant, maybe they're just describing the toenail of that elephant in eloquent detail, and there's the whole rest of it still to be deciphered. But they have that toenail down exact. And I think if we look at, for me especially, the Hindu system and the Chinese system are just so very eloquently woven together. It's when you begin to work with them, you start to see what's happening in the world differently. You start to step back and stop looking at what's going on in the world as causes, but start seeing them more as effects. And taking three steps back, you see the cause in a more energetic way. And then if you start making the changes from that energetic place, then what's happening in the world starts to just shift.
Do you think that it was an inevitable turn, the one toward rational reductionism?
Well, I think it was, if we wanted to, I mean, it's a choice. I think we wanted to learn a certain thing, and that was the way to get there. And so it was a choice whether it was inevitable or not. These are big questions. I don't really think too much about whether it was inevitable or not. It's just what happened. It's just a choice that we made. And to some really wonderful results, and some results that have taken us maybe down a road that isn't sustainable in the long run.
When we talk about being able to use this stuff, or where's the line here between saying this is what we are and using it? I mean, you either are it or you're not it, and you're utilizing it. So which are we?
Well, in our essence, we are spiritual beings. So if we don't remember our essence, it doesn't make us less spiritual beings. It just makes us spiritual beings without any memory. So, I mean, we are in our essence spiritual beings with the ability to interact with this level of reality in such a way that we co-create what's around us. We are doing it anyway. We are co-creating what's around us anyway. We're just doing it unconsciously and from habits and from fears and from places that are driven by the incomplete parts of ourselves. As we become more aware, then we start to co-create from a place of choice, from a place of, I would prefer to have connection than lack of connection. I would prefer to honor, you know, the God force in all life rather than to destroy it. So we can begin to make choices based on a deeper level of reality, I think, anyway.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of your book, then, what is it that we're going to learn on, you call it the path of energy, and we've talked about on this mm-hmm. show a lot, the pathless path and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are these two different concepts?
No, I don't think they are at all. What this book is really trying to demonstrate for people is that our bodies are already fully wired and are already interacting in the sea of energy that is all around us, whether we can define it well or not, and that we are already tapping into and receiving this information, and it is informing the choices and decisions that we make. However, it's overlaid with a lot of patterning. And if we were, you know, like, let me just give you an example. If you were standing in front of a bus and you suddenly realized you were going to get hit, certain energetic things would happen in your body. Your base chakra, which deals with physical survival, would light up and would energize the meridians in your leg. You would immediately feel fear. You'd have adrenaline rushing through your system. So the fear is informing you that you're not safe. It's giving you energy to get safe at the same time that your chakra that deals with physical safety is lit up and your legs are full of energy to run. So if we took a snapshot of that, that's a very definite pattern of energy in your field that's activated in that moment. Then if you took another situation where perhaps you're getting married or you're involved in significant ceremony and your heart chakra is open and your connection to the person next to you is flowing with energy back and forth and your crown is awakened, and you took that snapshot and put it next to the other, those are very two different places of awareness. So when we go through life continually activating just the fear-based fight-or-flight energy structure, then that's the only way we're going to see the world, and that's the only way we're going to react to it. So what these meditations do is shift us out of our patterned way of responding energetically and opening up new patterns of energy flow. And when we start to engage those patterns of energy flow, we have different states of consciousness that go with it, just like the state of consciousness that goes with standing in front of a bus versus standing in front of, I don't know, maybe that's bad, maybe that's not a good analogy, standing in front of a preacher to get married.
Well, let me ask you, what does that look like for you when, I don't want to even say, well, have you been in those states? I mean, obviously you have. So what does that
yes.
look like for you? What would be the difference between you and the person next to you if you were standing in front of a bus all opened up?
Just exactly what I just described. So light coming out of the lower chakras, that predominating all the energy in the system, then feeds that chakra, because that chakra in that moment is the most important chakra for keeping me safe. And so all the energy in the entire system is going to be there. So that would be the most predominant thing that you would see looking at me from outside, is that chakra was huge and energized and active. Versus getting married, then the chakra that might be most active would be the heart chakra, and all the energy in the system would be in the heart chakra and would be interacting with the layers of the aura that support and bring in those frequencies of love. And so all that I'm really trying to demonstrate there is that different configurations of energy through these chakras produce different states of mind. And so if we want to activate different states of mind, we can do that by creating different flows of energy in our body. And that's what these meditations are geared to do, is to create different flows of energy so we can access different levels of consciousness. From those levels of consciousness, we can then begin to look at, well, why do I always react when someone asks me a question like a bus is coming at me? Why am I stuck in that energetic framework? And you can begin to work it so that you can be in a different energetic place than you have been. You can get rid of some of your patterns.
Now, you just introduced a new word there, which is aura. So what is the aura, and what is its function in all this? And again, I'm sorry this is the back to basics for you, I'm sure.
Oh, no,
just,
this is
fine.
I always
hear these terms, and I never get them defined, so this is great.
Well, so let's go back to the Hindu system. In the Hindu system, as described to us by the theosophists at the turn of the 19th century, the aura is the energy emanation from our body that it has seven layers, and each layer relates to and interacts with a level of dimension of the universe. They believe that there are seven dimensions to the universe, and each of those dimensions was accessed by us through our aura. So information from the different dimensions comes into your energy field and gets taken to a very specific chakra. So the first layer of the aura relates to the first chakra, the second layer of the aura relates to the second chakra. And as the information that you're getting from that layer of dimensional reality goes into that chakra, it then informs your system of that. So it's a multidimensional wiring is what they're describing. And the thing is that we utilize such a very small part on a conscious level, but on an unconscious level, we're still wired. So my belief is that the paradigm shift that we're in right now, and I do believe we're in a paradigm shift, is that we're coming to a place where we will be able to access the information from all of these chakras simultaneously and choose what level of reality we want to interact with at any given time.
Levels of reality. So, okay, so I'm trying to wrap my mind around this, because it sounds like you're, from going by that then, that the chakra that we exercise the most, which is about fear and that sort of thing, is taking in information from a dimension that is fear?
No, it's taking in information from a dimension that's based on this physical reality level. And if fear is the emotion being triggered, it's because we're not safe in that moment. So let's just take a step back. Let's take a huge step back here and look at what emotions are. Emotions are the translations of energy coming into our body. So, for instance, if I'm standing in front of a bus and I'm not safe, and my body wants to tell me I'm not safe, the fastest way it can tell me I'm not safe is to produce a feeling of fear. And immediately, I don't need any words, I don't need anything else. I know I'm not safe because I'm afraid. So the emotion gives me information, and then it gives me energy to do something with it. And it doesn't matter what the emotion is. If someone impedes my progress, if someone puts obstacles in my path, I'm going to feel anger, and that anger is telling me that my boundaries have been breached. And it's going to give me enough energy to push people out of my way and get that boundary back up. And, you know, maybe guilt will tell me when I have breached someone else's boundary. So every emotion is giving us information about how we are in the world. And then that information determines how we react and how we respond. You know, our patterning around that information will determine how we react and how we respond. When we get back to the level of the aura, we have constantly interweaving through us all of this multidimensional information, and what that information is and how it affects us will be we'll respond to on an emotional level.
How does being this awake affect your dream life?
I have the most amazing dreams. And you know what's really cool is my husband and I have shared dreams. We dream the same dream together. Sometimes we'll even wake up and we're still talking to each other from a dream.
Wow.
It's pretty wild.
Does it change it in terms of, like, can you dream walk? Can you go walk about the world? And I had an experience after, actually, we had on Colin, where I think a Native American or somebody came into my dream and basically put his hand over my stomach in the dream, and I was awake. Mm-hmm. It was one of those things where I was awake and I was sort of toying with the idea of waking up, but I wanted to see where this dream was going. So I just sort of stuck with the visual, and he put his hand over my stomach, and basically, in real life, I felt a charge of something. I mean, it felt like a volt of energy go through me, and I had really bad back problems, and essentially he healed my back in this dream. Is that something that you could do if you were so alive with the chakras and the such?
Yes, I think absolutely. I think what you're describing is you know, the theosophists talk about, you know, this type of travel outside of the body at night, going to dream schools and learning in our dream states, going to places and helping other people in our dream states. There's some really fascinating research going on now around people who see other people who are dreaming. So, you know, the person's dreaming that they're in a certain place and the people in that place see that person. It's kind of a wild story, but what you just described is a classic description of meeting with one of your guides or meeting with a spiritual mentor who, you know, worked with you on an energetic level. And I wonder if Colin had told you the story, if that happened after your discussion with Colin, if he had told you the story about Chesfoot Head and Pat Delgado and scooping the energy from the crop circle into his chakras.
Yeah. In fact, you know, we had this back and forth, and it turns out Pat Delgado had some sort of Indian guide in his life. and we're wondering if that maybe wasn't him sort of responding to our conversation in some way.
So you are so demonstrating exactly what I'm talking about. Right now, as you're saying that, I'm getting goosebumps all over my body. So that is my body verifying for me on an energy, through a subtle energy feed, the validity of what you've just said. So I can say with certainness, yeah, that was Pat Delgado, and he visited you after that radio program. And, you know, how cool is that?
Yeah, it was great. It was very cool. So what does the world look like then if we all were to wake up like this? What becomes of humanity? Do we come to a different definition of ourselves, or could we still swing back on that pendulum and become what we are now? I mean, what happens to us?
Well, to me, the idea is that we don't abandon physicality, that we learn how to use physicality as an anchor to consciously go in and out from all of these different levels of awareness. So you can work in your dream time, you can work in those levels in your daytime reality, and your body becomes then this anchor. This isn't about ascending out of physical form. Physical form has a function, and it's a beautiful and wonderful thing. But when you start seeing energetically and start looking at the world through the eyes of energy, what the first thing you notice is that you're connected to everything else, and not only connected, you are everything else. It's not just that I have energy that streams to you and so you and I are connected. It's that you and I are both part of a larger organism. We are the larger organism, and so cruelty to you is cruelty to me. Cruelty anywhere on this planet is painful to me, and so the choices that we begin to make in the direction and what we hold as precious in a day changes, and it changes dramatically. And so the life that we create is a more compassionate life, is a gentler life, is a more loving life, is one where people are honored and valued rather than looked at for what you can get from them, you know, which is kind of our modality now is, you know, how much work can you get out of this person? How much money can you get out of this person? How much whatever, which is our current paradigm. So I think that this world of energy shifts us into a much easier way of living, a much more fulfilling way of living, and more exciting because the adventures out in the universe are pretty vast and amazing.
Well, how did you come to this?
You know, it's a funny thing. I think in some ways, like Colin, from a child, there was one thing that really interested me, and it was what was the difference between a live body and a dead body. My parents used to rehab wildlife a lot, and a lot of times wildlife that, you know, birds or raccoons that have been hit by cars don't make it, and it was a confusion to me that I could be looking in an animal's eye and feel the presence and the cognition, and then it's gone, you know, and so that became a real focus for me. And when I was about 12, I read my first book about auras written by Edgar Cayce. My parents were into Edgar Cayce, and that changed, that gave me something that I could grab hold of. I couldn't see auras. I spent a lot of cross-eyed hours trying to. I hurt my eyes. I never saw an aura that way. But what I discovered in petting my cat was that I could feel them, and I would notice about 2 inches off of the cat's body that there was a contour around her body, and that it felt like pushing against a magnetic field, and that when I interacted with her at that level and pushed against that field, she responded. She'd turn her head, she'd roll over. She was as involved in that interaction as I was and as aware of it as I was. And so it really made me realize that this subtle energy that I was thinking maybe I could see, but that my body was far too gross to feel, that wasn't actually true, that we are able to feel this and interact with it on many different levels. And that really was the beginning of a lifetime search. I've been doing it ever since.
Have you experienced anything that has surprised you?
Well, yes. Yes, I have.
Anything we could talk about?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different ones, and it's kind of hard because sometimes this can go into sort of frightening and not so easy things. You know, the other side of working with energy is that you're entangled with a lot of you know, because you can work with energy doesn't make you more spiritual. You can use energy in negative ways as well as positive ways. And certainly some of the things I've run into that I was surprised by were people using energy in negative ways and then interacting with that. Colin and I certainly experienced some rather heavy-duty psychic attack when he was when he was first talking about that some of the crop circles may be hoaxed. It drew a lot of very negative attention towards us, and some of the things that we witnessed were really quite extraordinary, like our entire electric system of the house being invaded and couplings exploding that couldn't be separated unless they were physically taken apart, you know, things like that, which were very physical expressions of a psychic energy. On the very positive side, I've certainly experienced, as you described, having beings show up, put their hands on the top of my head, filling me with light. It's always hard for me to talk about these because I don't want to make it seem like I'm saying that I'm something special, because I don't think I am or anyone is. I think we all have these experiences. I think sometimes we pay attention to them and most of the time we don't, but I think these experiences are happening all the time. And the one that, this was the inception of one of the meditations, which was Colin and I were feeling very painfully aware of the damage being done to rainforest and to the earth. And we were working at that time with some people who were deeply involved with the tribes of the Sierra Nevada in Colombia, who is a group of five tribes, the most well-known of which is the Koji because of
you've got
a book called The Elder Brothers. No.
This is hysterical. Well, this is hysterical because the way we're going to start off this episode, I'm going to tell a Koji story from when they came to New York to sort of tie together all of these various themes that we've been talking about.
We were there when. It's fascinating. All right. Well, so, were you in the Catskills in Menlo when they came to Menlo?
No, I of course was out of town at that point. But my friend Melissa and Barbara Three Crow were both parts of that Antiochus and Ghost Horse. Were you up there?
Well, yes, I was. My friend Alice Bradley is the emissary from the Koji who you know, kind of facilitated that happening.
I met Alice once.
And Alice certainly wants us to always remember that it is the tribes of all five of them. You know, we use the term Koji because of the Elder Brother video that Alan Aspect brought in. But nonetheless, so we, you know, in this experience, Colin and I were very deeply wanting to support them in some way because their whole system is being destroyed and they themselves feel that they hold a very important place in keeping the health of the planet. And so we were meditating, and in our meditation, suddenly a pyramid formed over our meditation and two beings sat at two sides of the pyramid, and we were at two other sides of the pyramid, and immediately all of this negativity started coming through the ley lines of the planet into this pyramid through a violet flame and out through the top as this incredible, beautiful love energy. And it was as if we were cleansing, you know, helping, that we were sitting there and anchoring something that could help cleanse some of the fear and anger and hatred that has accumulated in the aura of the earth and cleanse it. And that was really where that whole meditation, the pyramid purification meditation, comes from. And I'll tell you, it's very powerful when you do it, and especially when you do it with a group of people, things really do change. So that was, for me, one of the most meaningful of those types of experiences that I've had.
Wow, so our connection grows.
Yeah, I know, this is interesting.
Well, here's a question then that I was going to ask you that probably won't be as abstract as I thought it would be. The Kogi, or Koji, I guess I've always called them Kogi.
I think you're right.
Talk about these, I don't know what you would call them, evil entities, you know, demonic force, a presence, a something that sort of has its hold over us that they fend off in some way.
Well,
do you find that to be literal? Do you find that to be true? Is that a part of what you deal with?
It's a funny thing. Ellis was just talking about this on Sunday, actually. He was calling them the inorganics. And I have to admit, I'll fully admit, I don't understand it. I don't know the whole story. I don't know. I have not talked with the Mamus myself, and I don't know what what their whole thought form is around that. I would say that if you would like, I mean, maybe you should have Ellis on the show. But yes, certainly people can misuse energy like you can misuse electricity or any other force out there. And there is a chapter in the book that tells you how to protect yourself energetically and how to make sure that you yourself are not energetically and inadvertently harming another person. Because anytime we put out emotionally charged thought forms, anytime we send something at another person in anger or hatred, we're affecting them. We're causing harm to them on an energetic level. And so becoming, containing our own ability to do damage is an important part of protection as well.
Well, I guess let's make this abstract, because here's my real question is, do you think, or have you experienced, that there is something that is evil for evil's sake, let's say? Is there some dimension that is that? And if so, mm-hmm. Does it need to be that, or is it sort of the ending of The Wizard of Oz, when once you figure it all out, you know, your enemy is your friend, you know, they've been doing this theater with you all along to get you to grow or whatever, and suddenly you're dancing with monkeys.
Yeah, okay, so you're asking me now on a personal level, and I'm going to tell you how I feel about it. I'm not going to pretend that I know the truth overall bigger than anyone else, but I absolutely believe that there is only one force in the universe. And if I look, I'm a Taoist by nature, and if I look at the symbolism of yin and yang, we have the circle, which is the Tao, which is the all that is, and it is the everything. It divides into the two, the yin and the yang, and through the dynamic tension of the two, we get energy, and that energy creates everything that's around us. So you need that polarization in order to develop a dynamic tension to create energy. But ultimately, it is all one and it's all one force, and I do not actually believe that there is evil outside of the universe. I kind of go to Shirley MacLaine's definition that evil is energy flowing backwards. You know, it's just simply not moving in the right direction, but it is not a separate force. There is no separate force. That's how I see it. I'm not claiming to be right.
Right. Well, one of the things that we've talked about in the show, and we started off talking about in terms of ufology, but it really has sort of ended up, I think, going deeper than that, is what Jeff said, calls the more you give, the more you get. And so that basically, however you think about, say, a quote-unquote alien, you know, whatever that that being or intelligence ultimately is, we don't know, but whatever you think of it is what you're going to get back. So if you're fearful, you're going to get a fearful scenario. If you think Space Brothers, you might get Space Brothers back. And that sort of what you were saying before, that everyone has these experiences, but only some people pay attention. You think it's possible, this is something that Jeff has toyed with as an idea, that especially in childhood, whatever this intelligence is, puts out a hook, and whoever responds as a kid is the one who ends up getting more and more experiences, and however they feel about those experiences or interpret them colors what they're going to actually experience. Does that ring true to you?
Yes, it absolutely does, and to me it seems it's along the whole idea that whatever is radiating in our aura, whatever vibration is in our aura, is going to attract that energy to itself, and so the law of attraction, if you want to call it that, but that we are attracting those experiences to us, and of course, anything that wants to interact with us has to show up on a level that we can perceive and understand, and we can't perceive outside of what we can imagine, so if we can't imagine beyond a space brother, or if we can't imagine beyond a gray being with big eyes, that's what we're going to pull in and that's what we're going to see, because it can't talk to us outside of that. It's like that whole thing about inattentional blindness. I don't know if you ever watched that video on inattentional blindness, where you're watching this video, it's on the internet, you can Google it right now, and you're seeing two teams playing baseball, and there's two balls being passed, and you're asked to focus on one of those balls and tell them how many times that particular ball gets passed. People become so focused on counting the passes of that ball that at the end of it, they can tell you how many times. Well, what they never saw was that a man in a monkey suit walks out in the middle of the field and thumps his chest five times and then walks out. And most people don't ever see him because they never imagined he would be there. And their attention was so focused on what they were paying attention to that they missed it entirely. And I think that that is really a very important part of what it is that we draw to ourselves, is what are we capable of imagining? there are stories from Native Americans, and I have no way of verifying this. I have no way if it's true, but the idea being that when the ships arrived from Europe, Native Americans had no ability to conceptualize it, and so they virtually didn't see them on the horizon. They didn't see them until little boats, you know, little skiffs that they could relate to were set off and came towards shore, and so the first thing they saw were these boats, and the ship is sitting in the harbor, but no one saw it. I don't know.
Well, I imagine, especially working, I assume you work with Colin as well as being
yes.
his wife.
Yes.
And have you come across anything in your dealings that that is like that? I don't want to say is alien, but is alien? Mm-hmm. Is I mean, have you had those types of experiences?
We have had many experiences with interactive lights in the sky. We have had many experiences with like the alignment of energy, like you and I were just talking, and the Koji thing just came up and kind of aligned. We've had a lot of experiences with orbs and things like that. We have had no interaction with aliens in a physical body. Light beings, you know, in our meditations, yes. Physical aliens, no. Well, other than the fact that Colin did see... Yeah, all right, maybe we did. Maybe we did. I mean, I think Colin might have told you that story that we, the two of us, were heading into a restaurant in Cornwall in Sharon, Connecticut, actually, and as we were walking in, Colin hears a voice in his head that says, you're going to see an alien, and he turns around, and there's this woman walking in the door off of a bicycle, and everything about her was just wrong. Her angles were all wrong. It was like her elbows went backwards and her knees went in the wrong direction. And she stared right into him, walking by, turning her head so she can continue to stare at him. And afterwards, he's like, I just saw an alien.
Wow. No, you didn't tell us that. Wow.
Yeah, it was really quite strange. But it was a human figure. It was just a human figure that wasn't seemingly put together, but you wouldn't have noticed it. We wouldn't have thought a thing about it if he hadn't just had that. And he said to me, you know, before he actually saw her, he said to me, I just heard this voice that said, I'm going to see an alien.
Wow.
So.
Well, I know we don't have a lot of time left here, mm-hmm. but you must come back.
I'd love to, and I'm sure Colin would enjoy doing it together.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great. But let me ask you, because I'll be remiss if I don't, when you talk about seeing a pyramid when meditating, what does that, where is that? Is that in the mind's eye? And then is that, you know, how vivid of a visual is that?
Yes, thank you for bringing it up. It is definitely in the mind's eye, and it is as real as any conversation you have or any image that you see on the television or anything else. It's a completely real and interactive experience, but it is happening in the mind's eye. And the mind's eye, to me, is just giving you an inner vision of what's happening etherically, that your body is picking up on the etheric levels. But because our visual eyes can't record in that frequency range, the only place it can impress that image, I mean, like I'm looking out with my eyes, and what I'm seeing in my head is only what my eyes can record. There's all these other things happening out there at the same time. So what my body can record from the etheric level is what I see in my mind's eye. And it is absolutely real. It's interactive. And again, you know, you have the verification of its reality by how your body responds to it. In the same way that when you told me your experience, I suddenly had goosebumps and a sense of flow and sensations in my body that told me I was having an energy reaction to your information. It's the same. When you see these things etherically, you have an energy reaction that verifies its reality.
So, in essence, then, the message there is trust yourself.
Trust yourself, yes, and start to pay attention. Build your library of experiences so that you know what they mean. And that is in a nutshell, what my book is about, is helping people to build their library of their experiences and helping them to validate their own truth. I don't try in this book to say at all that my truth is the truth. These are some ways you can think about it. These are some practices you can try. But ultimately, it's what your body tells you and the library of experiences that you record that explain it to you that's important. So the book really just kind of helps people to validate themselves.
Well, the book is The Path of Energy. The author is Dr. Cynthia Andrews, and it has been a pleasure to meet you and to be able to speak with you. And I'm sorry Jeff has missed this.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. And if I could just say that if people want to know more, they can go to thepathofenergy.com, and there is a mentorship program there and other things that, and online courses and other things that they can tune into.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. You take care.
Bye-bye.
This is Colin Andrews, and you're listening to Paratopia.
Hey, Paratopia, Jeremy Vaney here to talk to you about something I mentioned last week, which is my movie Free Space, The Real Life Story of the Bingo Queen. It's a mock documentary. It's a comedy. I would love to make it with Philippe Mora. We're trying to kickstart it at kickstarter.com. Now, this has nothing to do with our Paratopia deal with Philippe. This is purely a side project, but it would be a hell of a lot of fun to make, and it would be super cheap to do. So if you go to Kickstarter.com and you use their search engine and put in my last name, Vaney, V-A-E-N-I, you will be brought to my page, which is Free Space, The Real Life Story of the Bingo Queen, where you can watch a funny little video, and you can look at the incentives to the right for donating handsomely. Of course, if you can't afford to donate handsomely, you can donate as little as $1. So if you've got $1 in your pocket, you can give it to me. And I can make a movie. If you can't afford that dollar, well, then here's the thing. If I don't raise 60 grand in 33 days, everybody gets their money back who donated. So the odds of us raising 60 grand are pretty slim, right? So you'll probably get that money right back. Of course, if you can afford to donate, then donate handsomely, and then we can make the movie. Win, win, win. Right? Triple win. I don't know what I'm saying anymore. Anyway, Kickstarter.com. Search term Vaney, give generously and give often, or give as little as a dollar. Help make this movie and help make our dreams come true. Thank you.
So
the Jeff.
So the Jer.
What'd you think of that episode? Good stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. What?
Jeff, you didn't even hear it yet.
I know.
I wish we could do an after chat about Dr. Andrews, but unfortunately, Jeff hasn't, well, I haven't had time to edit it yet, and Jeff hasn't had time to listen to it. So,
yeah.
My apologies, question mark? I don't know that that needs to be apologized for. It's just something I wish we could talk about, but maybe we'll talk about it next week.
Yeah.
In the meantime, James on our private forum wrote a post that is confusing. But
okay.
But I think I can distill his question down to this, and let's see if you have an answer. Because he's basically addressing the fact that you had crushed one of these beings, and it disintegrated in your hands.
Okay.
And he's basically asking, is it possible that there are aliens that are sending a signal to Earth that are creating, based on the feedback loop of our expectations, these sort of tulpa beings, basically, out of dust, out of particulates in the atmosphere, creating our expectation to interact with us. Perhaps as a means to take over the world, who knows? But, I mean, that's basically what he's asking. Do you think that that's possible, or do you think that that's probable? Of course, anything's possible.
Do I think it's probable?
Does that smack of anything that you've experienced? I guess maybe that's the sanest way to ask the question.
When I talked about the you know, crushing the head thing, that I mean I only postulated that this thing was made out of nothing. It felt like it was made out of air, and so that's why I took the leap to say maybe these things are made of like coagulated particles of pollution or whatever. In the sense that anything that would come in contact with you physically, I mean, it was sort of a way for me to explain the inanimate of it all, of not being a tangible thing that can be held in a box. once the you want to say soul or the mind of this thing leaves this cardboard sheath, the cardboard sheath falls apart and ceases to exist at that point, because that's all that was holding it together, was the mind of this thing.
So you think that the body of this was walking around the entire day before you crushed it?
Ooh.
Did it have a life? Did it? And then
did it exist independently of me perceiving
the soul of this thing goes into another body, and that's just sort of the way it functions.
Yeah, it might be. It might. Of course, I have no freaking idea. But I would say it's likely to me that, or it seems to feel right to me to say that the only time that they put on the suit is when they're interacting with you in a physical way. Because I have seen beings that are obviously non-physical. And so I would say when there is some sort of need for a tactile response, then that's when this is donned.
Well, how did you see beings that are non-physical? How did that happen?
I was at the shop at my dad's. I was just beginning to start a business as a sign guy, and I was a sign guy. I managed a major company in Baltimore for years, and then when the owner retired and moved on, I started my own and had a lot of clients from the previous business. And so in the very, very early stages of doing that, I was alone in the shop. It was daytime. I was sitting in the office, and the office door looks out into a large bay area type of thing. And there's a large pull-down door with, I don't know, five or six windows that go across in it. So you have light streaming in. By the way, this is not more than 2 minutes from where Lisa and I had our big experience with the red, the disc with the little red lights on it that basically set me off way back when in this. But I was sitting there at the desk, and Lee and I had been talking about some things that at least and I've been seeing around the house, which was these humps in the air, which I think I've talked about on the show before.
This is appear. Lee, your
Lee Town, yeah,
Lee Townsend, yeah. Your old ufological partner,
right?
Lisa is your wife,
correct?
The shop is where you worked,
yes.
And you're Jeff Ritzman. Go on.
That's correct.
God damn. Just want to make sure we're clear on everything.
Yes, we're clear.
Okay.
And so Lee and I have been talking about something we've been seeing in the house, which was, I was calling them humps in the air. They appeared to be disturbed air in the shape of an upside down U or an upside down half circle. And they moved, and they were about anywhere from 3 feet off the ground to 4 feet off the ground to maybe a little bit higher than that. And you would typically see them in corners, and you would see them a lot. Especially when we were in the condominium, we had white walls. And so white walls in dim lighting has a really interesting effect on the eye. You get kind of a staticky look at some points of the day if you stare long enough. And we have been seeing these for a couple of weeks maybe. And I was talking to Lee about it. I said, what do you think that is? I mean, it's very strange, and it's very obvious. It's not like the kind of thing you could catch out of the corner of your eye. You could look directly at these things and see them. And Lee's first response to me was, well, why don't you think something at it? Like, think something at it. Like, say hello in your head and just see what happens. And so I was at work. I saw something kind of out of the corner of my eye. And when I looked out, I didn't see anything, or I may have, I can't remember how this touched off for me, but I think I was eating and I was alone. The door was down. I put the door down so I didn't get bothered while I was eating, because everybody was always coming in and out. And I saw something, but it was much higher up than I'd ever seen something before. And it was fairly faint, but there was something floating up near the ceiling, and it was clearly not solid, almost ghost-like. And I remember thinking something at it like, hello, and it startled the hell out of me because I did get this response, which the only way to really describe it is not audible, not a voice in your head, but an absolute knowing that clearly isn't you. In other words, we all have that voice, that conscience in our head that you know is you talking to yourself. Now imagine something else talking, and it's clearly not you. And that's what this felt like. So that is jarring in and of itself.
Wait, how is that not telepathy?
I hate that word, but I guess that's it. And so, you know, I thought something, and I got a response back, which was a hello of sorts. And short of the story, you know, I'm sitting there, I'm looking at this thing, and it seems like there's form. And when I look, and the longer I'm sitting there looking and I'm thinking at it, the more solid it becomes until I'm looking at a being that is floating in the air, stomach down, knees bent, arms bent, but it's hovering in this spot in the air near the ceiling. And the light source, in other words, it got to the point where I could clearly tell what it was. It wasn't like these odd, funny, ghostly wisps. You could clearly tell something was illuminated. The problem was is that the illumination that was showing on this figure was not the illumination of the light from outside nor inside. It seemed to be from a completely different light source, which I found to be really eerie. And wherever it seemed to be dark. That's the parts you couldn't see of it. The only part you could see was whatever light source was on its side or its place or wherever it was, which clearly wasn't all here. Its light source was the only thing that you could see of it, if that makes sense. Kind of like a black velvet painting. You don't have lines and shapes on a black velvet painting. You only have the light that is shining on an object is the only thing that is really painted. That's kind of what this was like. And it was clearly an alien being, quote unquote, just what you've always heard. The big eyes, the triangle-ish, you know, rounded top head, very spindly. I could see its knee, part of its shin, part of its elbow, part of its chest, the face, you know, but as it would kind of float there, it would move a limb and certain limbs would go out of view for a moment and then come back. So it's clearly this light source on it that wasn't a light source from inside the room, nor the sun, nor anything like that. And so I count that as being a completely non-physical thing because it clearly was ghost-like. If you have to describe it in such a way, that's what I would describe it like. There was nothing there to touch or to feel. It was almost holographic looking.
Someone on our message board, it might have been David Raven Moon, was saying that if these beings are interdimensional, if they're, you know, fifth dimensional, say, mm-hmm. then they might look like something like that. We wouldn't be able to see them fully
because
mm-hmm. they'd have these other dimensions to them that we can't comprehend.
That would make sense to me.
But they would still be physical. Just not to us.
Just not to us, yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, that thing, you know, the thing is from that point, I would say, and I'll have to ask Lee about this, maybe he remembers better than I do, but I think that started about a good 3 to 4 weeks of seeing the humps in the air and thinking at them and then getting responses back to the point where Lee came over one night and we sat and waited for humps to appear in the air. I mean, as bizarre as this shit sounds, this
Did
is exactly. No.
I don't remember that.
No, he didn't. He was sitting on the couch. I was in my easy chair. We were in the living room of the condo, and I saw something over in the corner, which would have essentially been the entrance to our condominium from the outside hallway. I saw something there. And when I thought at it, it gave me a name. It said, say hello to so-and-so. And I looked at Lee and I said, it said, say hello to so-and-so. And he turned white. And he's like, I don't believe it. I said, well, I'm just telling you what. He's like, you don't understand. That is actually my birth name. That is my real name, which you don't know and couldn't have known because I've never told you. And he said, so that right there to me is, it's telling me you're not full of shit. You know, and then it went on to this crypto dialogue.
You know, it's
much
weird.
Like we've always heard about, like it's very cryptic and it's not, doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but the words that I related to him were what I was getting back.
Yeah, but you know what's weird about me? You just think about what the nature of that is. I mean, so they can so thoroughly read his mind or whatever they're reading, that they know what his birth name is. And yet you've got this disclosure movement that's like adamant that we're going to have, if we don't already, a handshake deal relationship with aliens. It's like, well, but if these are the aliens or the whatever they are, there's nothing we can keep from them. There's nothing, therefore, that we could give to them.
Right.
So what would be the nature of that relationship?
Yeah.
I mean, just think about that little simple statement there, Paratopia. There's nothing we can keep from them, so right. There's nothing that we can offer them.
Right.
I mean, that's it. That's it. Well, so if there are beings here that are communicating with us in this way, that can read us this way, then I've got to assume that on some level, it's for our benefit.
Right.
You know, however, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it can't be just, you know, and perhaps they profit off of our benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe it's a mutually serving interest that we don't understand. All I'm saying is, you know, once again, I'm confronted with just the sheer fact that this whole nuts and bolts, they're just like us. And, you know, that whole scenario just can't be true.
Well, it just doesn't match the phenomena in any meaningful way to me.
But now the thing that you saw, when it was coming into existence, because, you know, we're always talking about, in fact, we started this conversation off talking about them materializing off of a feedback loop of our beliefs.
Uh-huh.
Does it strike you that that's what was happening? Did you have an image in mind of, okay, this is what would appear before me, a little gray alien? Could you have easily seen Margaret Thatcher if you were thinking about Margaret Thatcher?
I don't know how to answer that.
Or does that not even apply? I mean, it may not even apply.
It seemed to be a completely spontaneous thing to me.
They would have shown up and been that anyway.
That's my opinion.
So
that's my opinion.
What does that do for the whole feedback loop belief thing? I mean, eventually we've got to get to the point where we figure out, okay, is that their form? Or is that the form that they're presenting to us for some reason other than that's what we expect to see?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can certainly say I was aware of that form by that point in time. So could that have been it? Yes, but I have to go back to being 9 years old and having the thing clap in my face with the walk lid hat on, and that looked like this. So I knew that face and that look from that age.
Did you have the sense that this was that very being?
No. Mm-mm. No, I didn't.
Did you have an emotion attached to them?
Well, the one at 9 kind of always, he was always in my head, but I always, you know, as you get older, you try to rationalize things away. You try to say, it's one of the most prominent memories in my mind, but that's because I was young and it was terrifying. And who knows what that was? Who knows where that came from? Who knows where the black sheets and the spinning white square and the blue light and the guy with the walk lid on and all of that? Who knows where all of that came from? And so you move on with life, but it's always in the back of your head because it is the most potent memories of that age that I do have. And that's the honest to God's truth. The best way to describe this is to have had an experience like that at that age. And for it still to be so present in your mind as to be able to picture it in complete visual clarity, but it's always internalized. It's always there, but you don't talk about it. And then all of a sudden to see something very, very similar to that, but not quite, but even close enough in a bookstore, when you're a full-grown adult, and it's like now some part of you that has been with you since that age is now all of a sudden out in media and the world is laying eyes on it. That was a really, really, really uncomfortable feeling, because that to me was just terrifying, because you feel like Neo in the Matrix. Holy shit, you mean that thing's real? I mean, that's what.
Yeah, it's outside confirmation.
Yes. This in the shop, seeing this ghostly floating thing, was a lot easier to take than at night in my house. And real. I mean, like ping a rock, seemingly real. This thing was distant and not quite there, and easier to swallow, I guess.
Yeah,
I mean,
but
for me,
it was talking to you. So, did you get a sense of an emotion from it, or a sense of purpose from it?
Any time that after that and during that, there was never really. We're not here to hurt you. We're not, like, you hear people talk about that and they say stuff like, we're not here to hurt you. Just relax, you know, blah, blah. I didn't get anything like that.
But you could hear its thoughts in your head, but you couldn't feel its feelings.
I could not feel any feeling from it that I can remember off the top of my head at this moment. I don't.
Did its voice have an intonation of any sort? Like, you know, happy, sad, angry? I mean, you can hear, you know,
kind
of a voice.
Right. Kind of, I don't want to say authoritarian, but kind of parent-ish, like authority, but kind, I guess. Is that the best way to put it, I suppose? And almost, God, what is the word? Giddy? I guess is the word, kind of like impish or... I mean, I've talked before about like a sardonic black humor type of thing. Like, I know that you know that I know that I'm freaking you out. That sort of thing. I mean, that's kind of like, that was kind of present in that moment. And always the, are you sure what you're seeing is what you're seeing? That kind of thing. That was always very present, especially back then. That was always very present. Like, I know you're there, or I know what you are, or that sort of thing. And it would always be, were you sure you're seeing what you're seeing? Do you know what you're seeing? Do you know what we are? You think you know, but do you know? Are you sure about that? That kind of thing. In other words, I hand you an apple and I go, Jeremy, look at that in your hand. You go, yeah, it's an apple. I say, are you sure it's an apple? Is it really there? And these things had an ability just through questioning for you to doubt your own sanity at times with the way that they voice things. You know, like, are you really, like, you're questioning reality all the time. You begin to really question what you are perceiving. And they initiate that. They initiate you questioning what you're seeing, what you're perceiving of them. That's very present. But this seemed at arm's length and distant, and I didn't feel it was going to fly at me or try to grab me or anything like that. There was fear in the sense that I heard something that wasn't me. That was the most disturbing part. That is a very, very disturbing thing to get kind of past. But after a while, even that becomes easier to take, because you realize it's not quite as... Like, it sounds really invasive when you describe it out loud, but when you actually have it, the first time will kind of set you back. But after that, it seems very benign. It seems very, it almost seems like it's natural to a certain point. I guess that's the best way to describe it. You get used to it really quickly.
So you
but
said that
it's just disturbing when it's, sometimes it's, when it is like an audible thing, when it feels like an audible thing that isn't your internal voice, that's really disturbing. That I don't think get over as quickly. This knowing this voice that is not you is a lot easier to swallow and a lot easier to get used to. And there can actually be an exchange of some sort, but I don't know that you will understand everything that's being said for years later after you digest it over a decade. then I think maybe you might get a little bit more. I think during the conversation, you'll be like, well, what the fuck does that mean?
Well, what was the conversation? You said it was convoluted.
Well, at the shop, off the top of my head right now, I honestly can't remember everything. I remember saying something like, you want some of my chicken or something like that, like something really dumb, because I wasn't quite buying it, you know? And it was like, you know, no thanks. I don't remember if I asked something like, you're not really here, are you? I don't remember if that's what I asked or not, but to put at least the listener into a headspace, like if I had asked, you're not really here, are you? Back then I could very easily surmise that the answer would have been something like, well, I'm sort of here, but I'm not quite here. And it would have been an answer like that, a real, like a nonsensical answer or a cryptic answer. Almost like you're expected to understand what that means at that moment. If I'm not mistaken, I think Lee wrote down questions the night that he came over and we had this back and forth. But that got even to a point where I think Lee would ask questions to me, like verbally. Lisa and I one day were in the bedroom and I saw one and I said, hey, you said that you wanted to ask a question. Well, why don't you go ahead and do it? She goes, I'm not asking it out loud. If it knows what Lee's name was and all of that, then all I have to do is think something, right? I said, I guess. Go ahead. And the only thing that I got back was, we would never let anything happen to him. He's very important to us. And I said that to her, and she burst out into tears and ran out of the room. And so when I asked her what was the problem, she said, I asked them, were they going to hurt our son? And that was the response that I heard. And she hadn't asked the question out loud. So, you know, it got to a point where other people, I don't think, even had to ask something out loud. It just had to be thought of, and then I would hear something.
What happened to the notes that Lee took?
I don't know. Well, I don't know. I mean, for my part of it, I can say that I had tons of notes. I had journals. My God, the books that I had that I barely cracked, but I would see a book on the subject and get it and leaf three pages in and say, nah, you know, no good. Or I would have people send me books that I'd met here and there, and I wouldn't read. But I mean, I had tons of field notes. I had tons of manila folders filled with contact experience notes that I had taken down from people I'd met, to sighting reports, to all sorts of different things I'd printed off. And I reached a point in my life where I walked away from it. And for a lot of reasons, some of them personal, some of them not so personal, but Lisa and I, and she can attest to this, we took boxes out to the dumpster and threw them away. I didn't want anything to do with this ever, ever again, ever.
Why?
And first of all, I felt it was pointless.
Well,
number
is that
one.
How it stopped?
Yes, that's how I slacked off of it, ignored it, denied it, didn't have anything to do with it.
Do you see that in here?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I've always said that. Yeah, absolutely. Shit don't stink till you stir it, as Lee would say. And that's not to say nothing happened in the course of me ignoring it. There were always things that happened, but they were away. They were not, you know, I've said before, you know, this thing is like on the end of a rope, and the rope could be a quarter mile away, and you may have a quarter mile sighting one day and say, wow, that was amazing. And if you continue to pull on that rope, it's going to get closer and closer until it's in your lap. And that's exactly how it seemed to work for me. I would see very, very strange things every once in a while, but not to the frequency that I was when I was knee deep in it. And those around me saw things. So, it, you know, this was not, again, a bump in the night peaked for listening type of thing. So we dumped everything practically that I had. I have very, very, very little left. And most of it in the forms of just a couple of spiral notebooks that I kept, which had the symbol that showed up on my mirror, and what surrounded that. Like, that's really what I kept. And I kept the mirror, too, for as long as I could until it grew mold on it. Everything else I got rid of. I just did not want anything to do with it. That was due to being threatened or, you know, by people that that was in conjunction with a case that scared the shit out of me. At that point, that was pretty much my last straw at that given moment. And then, you know, other personal reasons just made me want to get away from it. So I don't have these great detailed notes. That's why I'm having such a hard time writing this book, because I have all the memory of it, but chronologically, it's tough to remember how it all fit together. You know, I mean, I there are pinnacle things that I remember, and then as I'm remembering those pinnacle things and writing them down, I go, "Oh, wait a minute, what about before that? Remember when this happened?" Lisa go, "Yeah, where does that fit in?" And we have to sit down and like correlate these things all into some kind of cohesive chronology. That's what's been really tough about doing that. So I'm not going off any notes. This is just what I remember outright.
Just thinking back, even if you can't remember what was said, what do you think was important about that entire exchange? Do you think what was said was important? Do you think how it was said was important? Or do you think, I don't know, what do you think? If it wasn't, I mean, because clearly whatever was said wasn't so impressive that it's ingrained in your memory forever.
No.
But the situation is. So what was important about that whole situation, do you think?
Right. I think that it was the – and this was probably the start of other people starting to see or to experience some of what I was. So that for me it was confirmation that it wasn't all in my head and that I wasn't just freaking myself out and that I wasn't attributing coincidence and synchronicities to this when it was something else. This it was confirmation for me that this was able to interact with other people, whether it be independent of me or by something that I would say based on talking to a hump in the fucking air. There was that part of it. And I think the other half of it is that I brought, and this is the part that kind of disturbs me about this, which is, you know, am I, and I thought about this a lot at the time too. If this, at the time I said, if this is a negative thing that's interacting with me and it's not a positive thing and I'm being deceived or I'm being fooled, then I'm bringing other people into the fold with this. And so am I spreading a disease of some sort here of that sort of thing? Because I did have friends who never had a paranormal experience in their life until they'd come over to the house and we'd talk about it for 4 or 5 hours. And then they'd go home and call me when they got home at 2 or 3 in the morning and say, "You're never going to believe what just happened to me. You know, a ball rolled down my driveway from a closed door that I have no idea why this ball ran down, you know, rolled down the driveway. I have no idea why this happened or that happened." I had that a lot. And that's when people stopped coming around. I mean, I had friends that just dropped completely out of sight. I think that was the other half of it, is that somehow I felt like this indoctrination point of bringing other people into realizing something was going on and something was real, and maybe they would then engage it. You see what I mean? So it's like, if it depends upon us to acknowledge it, to manifest itself, am I bringing fuel to the fire? In other words, to make it be able to manifest more and more and more. Is that what this is? And of course, that's, I don't know that I believe that anymore, but that was my thought at the time. So what I got out of that, just independent, you know, I knew what was going on was not, I'm not crazy. I'm not, this is real. It's interacting with people that I can't know their mind. I can't know things about them that these things can tell me, and that's it.
And this was the last thing that happened after the, let's call them Men in Black for shits and giggles, after the Men in Black showed up and scared you out of the case. This is, this happened just prior to that?
Not just. It was, I think it was some, it was a good while before that, I think.
But the, yeah, okay, so was this the most important thing happening at the time?
When that at the time, yeah, at the time. I think this was right around the time where I I mean, my son was a baby. He was a baby. He was still in the crib, as far as I can remember, because this is probably right around. I think a little bit before that was when he was in the crib and I was in my easy chair and I fell asleep, and I woke up and I got something to drink and I put something in the microwave, went to the bathroom, and as I went past his room, we had the door just ajar, and he had a window in his room. Across from us was the swimming pool and the tennis courts and all of that, so there's lots of light from over on that side. And in the room, I saw something bent over his crib. And I went to open the door, and that's when I heard the not knowing, but the audible, scratchy-voiced, almost like a radio-sounding, demodulated voice, you know, go sit down. don't come in here. Go sit down. And I did it. I didn't go in. Something's in there with my child, and I go out and I sit down. And I sit in my chair, and I literally feel like I could move, but I'm not going to move. Well, I'm staying right where I am.
Let's put that on hold and come back to that in a second, because I just want to get to the question of, I don't know, this is sort of a heady question, I guess, but maybe I'll ask it this way. Did you, when you came back to this after leaving it for so long, what was in your mind when you came back? Was it that incident with the humps in the air? I mean, what made it so that you came back?
What made me come? I think the aspect that I could be involved so on the edge of it, not to engage it, but to focus more on the expose of fraud and hoax and stuff like that. Like, that's how kind of that I got back in.
But, I mean, if you threw it away, I mean, you and your wife literally threw things away and said, we are cut off from this.
Right.
I imagine that that's a lot harder to do after you've had a conversation with these beings.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's one thing if you've had, like, some fleeting incidents or a lot of fleeting odd incidents that you don't know what to make of.
Yeah, this affected a good chunk of my life, yeah.
Right, but that you can sort of put in the back and go, okay. It's kind of like what you said with seeing, you know, Strieber's book cover. It's like confirmation. Well, this is like confirmation part two. This is like, here it is in the room with you and other people, and it's talking. It's like, I imagine that that sets up something in your brain that's a little bit harder to ignore, even after you've gone through the act of blocking it out and throwing it away.
Yeah.
So do you think that that was by design? I mean, if you had to look at the, I mean, this is sort of a bigger meta question, which gets into, you know, if these beings can, to us, it seems as though they're reading minds.
Right.
But what are they really doing? Is there a timelessness that they're coming from? A timeless spacelessness aspect that they're coming from? I mean, are they setting things up in time in that way, knowing what the outcome is going to be? Is this math to them? A plus B plus C, and that math is your destiny if you, well, I don't know. I want to say if you stick with it, but maybe, do you have a choice?
You know, this all gets very deep. This all gets very deep because, for me at least, I mean, I can tell you how. And I'll, you know, I've said this before on other shows, and I don't think that our listenership is going to really, like, buy this, but this is it. I mean, this is it. I would say, yeah, did the guys come into my work that night and essentially threaten me? Did that scare me? Yes. Did that make me want to walk away from it? Yes. Did that make me want to, like, I don't want any more to do with this? It, you know, yes. But as you said, it's very hard to walk away from. And I would say a good while before you ever heard anybody talk about this thing being inherently evil, quote unquote evil, is when I sat down and we are in the process of getting rid of the stuff. And I'm going through these reports and I'm looking at them, just going over them, thinking, there's something here I've missed. There's, you know, this stuff is, I'm getting rid of this, but, you know, I'm going through it and I see this consistency of exactly what George Hansen said on one of our earliest shows, you know, the not good for relationships and the loss of jobs and the chaos in life and misery that can accompany that. And you see, excuse me, you see all that stuff and you go, okay, well, here's where I really should be looking is in how it affects a person, not how many windows did it have and what did the beings look like, but what happened to that person both at the experience and then afterward. And ended up making some calls to some people, and I was really surprised at how badly it had impacted their lives. And so then I looked at my own life, and I thought, it's done the same thing to me. I have, you know, I have been fear-ridden. I have been debilitated in my life from these experiences, and that's what it's done to me. And when I really took a hard look at all that, I said, you know, if I was a certain sort of person, I would say this is a demonic thing. Now, at the same time, I'm due to speak at a conference in 1 week, and I'm not too thrilled about having to do that, but I'm obligated to do it. I have to do it. So I've got to do that, and then I can probably extricate myself away from it. I came upon this. It was like this huge epiphany. Like, that's what this is. That's really what this is. It is inherently evil. It is toxic. It is demonic, even though if we don't really know what demonic means. That's what it is, you know? And I said, so now my quandary is, do I go to this conference where I'm supposed to talk about my experiences and do what I'd always done at lectures is to talk about from the beginning of my experiences and up to present day, or do I take the responsibility? I'm leaving this anyway. If I'm badly received, who cares? At least I'm telling the truth of what I have arrived at. And so that night, a friend of ours, a couple, they came over and we were talking about this. And I said, you know, here's what I think. And here's why I think this. And I showed them, you know, why do I think this way? And they're like, yeah, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. I don't know. I mean, you would know better than us, but what are you going to say to those people? Like, this is not going to go over very well. I'm like, well, I don't really care. Like, I feel like I've got an obligation here to do this. And so at the same time, I was really torn. Like, am I going to go there and say it's demons and have half the people walk out? Like, how? I mean, that would be like grossly embarrassing to me. And I was always ultra nervous at public speaking anyway. So how bad would that be to stand up in front of all these people and do that? And they left. They went home. It was very late. Lisa and I went to bed. We got up the next morning. And the first thing she said to me was, did anybody come over last night after they left? And I said, no. She said, why do I feel like we had a house full of people after they left? And I said, I don't know, but we didn't. We went to bed. So I kind of blew it off. I went to the bathroom. I combed my hair. I go in to put my jacket on. She's already at the door. And as I look up in the mirror that is there on our dresser, we have two mirrors. And one of them, nearest to my place at the bed, is this symbol. And it's scrawled. It looks like it's scrawled into the mirror, but it turned out it was actually scrawled in some kind of white waxy substance. And before anybody asked, no, I never got it analyzed. I did take it with me to the conference. I showed it to everyone. But before I even did that, I made a call to Mario Pasiglini, who had given a talk at our local MUFON thing about alien symbology and ancient writing and all this. I faxed it to him. And his answer, I said, what does it mean? Have you ever seen anything like it before? And he said, no. He said, but it is angelic writing. And he said that he had not seen it in that configuration before, but what he got from it was that the configuration it was in said, and here's the word for you, urgency, in the way that it was presented. He said it seems to be an urgent message or a poignant message. And I said, so what does it mean? What he's well, does it, it's not a translation. He says, I can't give you a translation. I can give you what it's implying from my perspective is now you know, do you have the courage to stand up for what you believe? He said, does that mean anything to you? And I was just like, bah, are you shitting me? So at that point, there was no more guesswork. I'm going to this conference, and I'm going to tell everybody what I think it is. And I did. And and some people walked out, but only two. And I got a standing ovation when it was over with. And I made the statement. I said, look, I know this is not going to be popular because I know what some of the other experiencers here talking to you have said. But here's what I walk away from. And here's where I leave it. Here's where I table it for myself. And you can take what I say with a grain of salt, or you can look further for your own, you know, peace of mind. It was surprisingly overall really well received, and a lot of people asking more questions about it. And so I felt good about it. And then we went to a dinner afterwards, and Dick Hall, who was in the audience, came up to me at the table where all of the speakers were sitting. And he came up to me, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he puts his hand out, and I shake his hand. And he says, with the straightest face ever, I mean, he says, I just want to really congratulate you on your talk. And I said, thank you. And he smiled at me and he walked away. And I was never invited to another conference to speak.
So
and that was it.
You told them that you thought it was demons.
I did.
Okay. So here's what's
And at that point, I was out. Almost. I was pretty much out from that point.
Here's what's interesting to me about this.
Mm-hmm.
The surface level, of course, makes it look like demons wrote on your mirror. So you, now that you know, do you have the balls to say it?
Right.
But that challenge, it's not demons. So that challenge is, you know, I was just watching, I told you, you know, privately, I've been watching Joseph Campbell's Power of Myth Part 2.
Uh-huh.
And they were talking about Kundalini yoga and what the chakras mean going up and down the spine and the various metaphorical deities that are associated with these things. And the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, it's descending into life from, say, the top chakra. And as you descend, I mean, you come to these points where you meet up with these gods. And you can, it's just the same dilemma we have with the quote-unquote aliens, which is they present themselves as a lovey-dovey, blissed-out thing, but then they also present themselves as evil, demonic, whatever. And, of course, mm-hmm. the point is for you to not be afraid of that, because mm-hmm. in the end, these are aspects of yourself, and there are no gods in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And if you pass that test, then, well, if it's descending, then you get to live in a higher state of consciousness, let's say.
Okay.
To me, that this challenge could ring true to that, where it doesn't matter whether it's demons or not. You know what I mean? Like, the challenge isn't, yes, we're demons, and now you know. The challenge is, okay, so in your heart of hearts, you think you know what this is all about. It doesn't even matter what it's all about, right? It's the inkblot test.
Now do you have the balls?
Now do you have the balls to stand behind your conviction?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's important. It's the thing that's not
right.
important is whether this is demons or angels or whatever. The thing mm-hmm. is, do you have the courage to stand up for, you know, and say it, to say what you believe?
Right, right.
And then once you do that, well, you've passed the test. And then what's the next thing you realize about these things? Well, it's probably not demons.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
But this all gets back to what I've been saying for freaking ever, and what I think the Master of the Key said to Whitley Strieber, which is, you know, it's the old adage of your enemy is your friend. That there is a play going on here, and it's, I think the Master of the Key puts it as, adding more weight to the weightlifter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these things appear to be your enemy, but they're not. And when you hear those words, you know, you think you get what that means, but it's like when spiritual people talk about living in illusion. Well, it's a functional illusion. Hit the table's there. You know, mm-hmm. stab yourself with a knife, it hurts like hell.
Right.
There's no getting around that. So just to say, oh, it's all an illusion, and have this sort of blissed out concept that means something. I mean, it doesn't mean anything, because mm-hmm. you're living the reality of the illusion.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're living the reality of aliens as an enemy or as demons or whatever, then that is what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there is a truth that's beyond that, that transcends that, that truth hasn't reached you yet.
Yeah, in the current framework, that is what it is. Yes.
I don't know. I find it fascinating. I find it fascinating that it applies to this stuff. You know, like, why aren't more people seeing this? It just boggles the mind.
Well, I mean, I think if had I never come back to it, I would still think that. Like, if I hadn't come back to this, I would have never found essentially the woman who changed my mind abruptly. I always still had it in the back of my head that this is not something to be trifled with. I still believe it's nothing to be trifled with, but I did not want to point blank ever engage this again. From that standpoint, I figured I could keep myself out of that by applying more to the technical aspect of analyzing data. And when Lisa said to me, you know, you're going to be right back into this, we're going to be having the same old shit again, and is that what you really want? You know, I love you, and I'm not going anywhere, but you know what happens, and you know what it does to you, and you know what it does to us. And if you're willing to walk down that road again, at least we know a little bit more about what to expect. Well, little did we know. But you're going to be in knee-deep again before you know it. And I said, nope, I'm keeping it to strict technicality. And now look where I am again. And so had I not come back, I would never have heard probably of Dorothy Izott. And that is the woman that, like it or not, folks, that's the woman who changed my mind about how we perceive this and how it presents itself to us based upon ourselves. And so I look at that and I go, they were demons because that was how I approached it, with fear, with all of that. And for some people, there's no other way to approach it. For me, I mean, still to this day, there's no other way to approach it but to be somewhat fearful of it and stand off of it.
But if it was that evolver God concept, then at that moment it was demons.
Right, exactly.
I think that's the point that's like sort of hard to get at. It's not like just that you thought it was demons and so it presented this thing.
No, it's like, not just that, no.
No, it becomes that.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then it's up to you to somehow go to see through that and go, well, wait a minute, what's really going on here? I mean, like these challenges to see through something, to see through the apparent reality that is all around you and go, well, wait a minute, what's really going on here? I mean, that's the nature of all of this spiritual stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That is the most difficult thing to do, because why should you do that? What's apparent is right before your very
it's
eyes.
It's right in front of you,
your
yeah.
Eyes are in your head, and your head is the thing that's thinking. You know, it's like, this is
all makes sense, right, yeah. Well, when you think about it, it's all this paranormal stuff. That's what it does. It's always challenging. It's always challenging. I mean, show me a case where your belief in whatever you think it is isn't challenged.
But see, the beauty of it is it doesn't have to be challenging, because ghosts, you know, you've got these ghost hunting groups, mm-hmm. and they've got their equipment, and they pretty much know the several categories that they believe this thing is.
Right.
Or you've got alien, you know, UFO hunters or whatever. You know, you're going to get to it through a series of political maneuvers or through testimony from witnesses and all this. I mean, uh-huh. figure this out, you know. You
right.
don't have to. You don't have to look any deeper than that. You don't have to.
Right.
And it will stay that way. It will mm-hmm. stay that surface, shallow, you know, a ghost is just grandpa talking sort of thing.
Yes.
If that's where you are with it, or it will right. change if that's where you are with it.
Well, there's parts where I say that one of these days, just like with hypnosis and the whole abduction field, and how I like to think that we've overcome that mask of this, and that now we've moved on to the next step past that. I think the same thing is going to end up happening in the ghost community. I think sooner or later someone is going to trip across something, and I'll lay money right now. I'll bet you it's going to end up being Dave Rowntree, who finds something really interesting that doesn't point to grandpa talking, but something completely out of left field that flies in the face of everything people think they know about what this is. And then after a while, just like we've seen the hypnosis downfall percolate throughout the community, it's going to percolate throughout the ghost community that this is not what we think it is, and it's actually much deeper than what we thought, and now we're going to start examining this. And it's just going to be a continual lead-on of discovery and then discovery, and so on and so forth, which to me feels an awful lot like a ladder that you're climbing towards some ultimate answer, if that's possible.
We only have a little time left here in my interview with you, Jeff, so...
Yes. Thanks for having me, Jer.
Let me get back to... And thanks, James, because we didn't know what we were even going to talk about in this after
chat.
Yeah,
thanks,
so,
James. That was a good point.
No, it wasn't, but it did spark this conversation.
It was good. Yeah, it was good. It was a good point to bring up.
I'm just picking on you, James. So, well, I want to go back, though, for a second to...
Yeah.
Because I said I would, which is when... You approach your son's door,
uh-huh.
He's in the crib and something's hovering over it and it says, go sit in the chair, and you
yeah.
do that. You know, you've mentioned this scenario a bunch of times, and every time you say that you did it, you giggle nervously and guilty, like,
mm-hmm.
and why shouldn't you? Because here you are a man, a father,
yeah,
and you are seemingly of your own volition doing this, and I imagine that is emasculating and humiliating, and you can't and you can't go to therapy for it. What the fuck do you do with that as just a human being?
I don't know, but I'll tell any experiencer out there that if you have a small child and you think that little child's involved in that kind of scenario happens to you, don't tell your wife. Never tell your wife.
What did she do?
Oh, she hit me. She didn't hit me. I mean, she pushed me. She's like, what the hell is wrong with you? I mean, I'm like, you don't seem to understand. You know, this is not, I mean, if it was an intruder or, I mean, I've bitch slapped people for messing with my kid. I mean, literally, I've done that in crowded stores for screwing with my kid, you know, bullying him or whatever. I mean, I've hit grown men for pulling shenanigans in that sense. But this is, you can't go into that room. I mean, that's it. And I always describe that voice because I can't say that it was common or really common to, number one, hear that tinny voice sound. Like, I've heard it a few times, but it's not like I heard that all the time. But number one, not only was that startling and fearful, but number two, it was said in such a way as that it was almost like it was said behind gnashed teeth. It was said in that really angry school teacher way of, go sit down, that kind of, and you just felt like, here's really I've over years of thinking about it, this is kind of the, I don't know if you call this metaphoric or just a kind of my thought exercise in thinking about how did I allow something to do that to me, and how did I obey it, or how did I say, okay, I'll go sit in the chair. You got the definite impression. And it was not communicated. It was not anything visible, nothing like that. You got the definitive feeling that to not listen would mean to just be completely like, welcome to oblivion. Because this is, you fuck with me and this is what you're going to get. I mean, it was that kind of, you know. You could stand up to 10 really bad biker dudes in a bar before you'd ever, and that would be like completely out of the question for most of the population out there. This, I don't care if you weigh 110 pounds or 510 and you're a bodybuilder or a biker or a gang member, I don't care who you are. You will do absolutely, barring being told to do something bad, like go do this. I mean, you wouldn't do that. But in a situation where there's something there that is not, it's very hard to describe. Like, it's in the room with your kid. You don't know what it's doing, but somehow you know it's not going to take him away and it's not going to hurt him. But at the same time, you don't know what it is, and you know it's made you incredibly fearful throughout your life. And now, is it happening to your kid? Is this how it starts? Like, did it start for me at that age? And am I witnessing the continuance here? Is that what this is? Or is it strictly putting on a play for me that now I'm in the room with your kid? What are you going to do now?
was it, again, pushing my buttons to say, you're going to come through the door or are you going to let me stand here with your kid and you don't know what the fuck I am? But to disobey it or to not do it, at the moment, you just feel like it could snap its fingers and you would cease to be. As dumb as that sounds, that's the doom-like feeling that I talk about sometimes, where you have this extreme sense of dread about what these things can do.
Well, how do you deal with things, I mean, like that? Do you cry? Do you get emotional about things?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the same time, and this is going to sound so fucked up to people, but as much as you're afraid of them, as much as it is so outside of the realm of your normal life, like friends and work and all that, and it's so there, it's so as present as all of that and even more present in many ways, and you want to defend against it and you want to, like, there's something about it that reminded me so much of what Ted said about recording the lights out in Arizona. Like, you're there and you're so overtaken that you forget to pick up the camera and collect the data. It's almost like that. It's almost like you know you should be doing something, but you're afraid of it, so you back off. But then again, there's something about it that you just know it's not really going to do something. It's not going to take your kid away. It's not going to threaten anything. But it's in there with your kid. But it's okay. But relax, but just sit down. You somehow figure it can't do anything. I'm still here. It's not like you're trying to justify all this at one time, and you can't. It makes no sense to say there's something in the room with my kid and I wouldn't go in to find out what it's doing. But at the same point, I say it's okay. Like, it wasn't okay. But something tells you it's okay. Like, it's all right. It's all right. You know, like, it's cool. I'll sit down because I'm scared of you. So I'll sit down. And whatever you're doing in there is what you're doing. And it wasn't like the kid was screaming. He was cooing. I mean, so obviously it wasn't hurting him in any way. But what is it doing? There's something about this that is, it's got a very pacifying way about it that doesn't allow you to become so upset with what it's doing and how it challenges you. I don't know how to verbalize that. I can't explain that. It's just a feeling that you have that once it's over, it was like, it was okay. And you should be angry and you should feel emasculated, you know, and at a certain level you do, but it's not nearly as bad as you think it would be. Like, on some level, you go, it's okay. It's all right. You know, this is all part of this whatever. This is, it's okay. You don't know what the whatever is. You just think it's okay. I can't explain it any better than that. I don't know what else to say about that. That's it.
That is the theme of this show.
I mean, isn't that? I mean, I hope that's an explanation.
I think it is, you know.
I don't know how else to verbalize it other than to say, there's nothing you can do about it. So what are you gonna do? It's not like you have an option to go in the room or not. There is no option. There is no option. You know, you know that you can't go in there, and that's it. That's it. There is no other option. The option is not to bust in and punch it in the face. You know. I mean, do I believe for a second that the one I grabbed its face and pressed my thumbs between its eyes, do I think for a second that that wasn't supposed to happen? I think that was absolutely supposed to happen. I think everything that's happened to me that I think is like, oh, I got him, or I made some kind of, you know, a push. I pushed back. Those pushbacks, that's meant to happen. I don't think for a second if you wanted to get your hands on this thing and it wasn't meant for you to get your hands on it that you would be able to touch it. No way. Absolutely no fucking way.
A to B to C.
Yeah.
Human destiny as alien math on the next Paratopia.
Okay. All right, then.
Well, that's what it is, isn't it?
I guess. I don't know what the fuck it is.
I mean, it's interesting, because even thinking about multidimensional beings. I mean, we think of that telepathy sort of thing as reading a mind. What does that mean? Reading someone's brain? Reading, picking up the chemical signatures in a brain? Like, what does that mean? Could it be that if they see other dimensions that we also exist in but don't acknowledge or can't comprehend, are they seeing, for instance, an extension of ourselves in the way that we're talking to, here we go, let's go full circle, back to Cynthia Andrews, is there something like an aura or like a chakra or a something, some piece of us that is the communicator, let's say, the pulsing information of our communications and of our history that exists in this other dimension that they see and that we don't, and that it's just a simple matter of looking at that. It's not they're picking stuff out of our brain. It's not that they're reading our minds. It's that it's all right there in this sort of bubble in the ether, and they're from the ether, so they see the bubble, and then they can act accordingly. If we add another layer to that, which is a timelessness, you know, they exist out of our time. Then could they even see all of everything as a tapestry? And so when they see, or possibilities, you know, all of these possibilities of tapestry. So if they see dudes who are going to come harass you about a case, do they then go, okay, so we're going to counterbalance that with this? Because we pretty much know what the effect of that is going to be on young Jeffrey here. And we want back in. So we're going to plant the seed here, and when this happens, he's going to come back to us because the seed has been planted.
Well, yeah, I could see that. I mean, here's the one thing I can tell you is that when I first decided all those years ago to really doggedly pursue this based on my own childhood stuff, I was on a deck looking out over a field, and there was this feeling of going into this, like really going to pursue this, like this is going to be something that I'm going to devote a lot of time to and a lot of effort to. And when I had that determination to do that, to really poke this thing now, there was this feeling that came over to me of like, it's the rightest thing you've ever said. Like, this is the right thing for you to do. Now, I can't explain that, but there's never been a decision in my life that I've ever made before or since that I have said unequivocally, yes, that is, I got this feeling of absolution of, yes, that is absolutely where you need to go. That is absolutely what you need to do. And it was the most sure feeling I ever had in my life. And then when it was time to leave it and when I was trying to get out, it again was the most absolute feeling I'd ever had. Like, yes, it's right to walk away. It's right to get rid of it. It will leave me alone if I leave it alone. Now I know, throw it away. And then to come back in, I thought, this is not the kind of thing you can dip your pinky toe in. Doesn't work that way. You either are in up to your neck, your waist, or your knees. I mean, there is no like casual interest in it when it involves you or when you are trying to keep tabs on it or trying to do something in it. That doesn't work. It's almost like it demands, you know, I'm all in. You know, it's constantly calling the bluff for that. I think in no small part, it does lead you through some kind. There is a progression to this, and I see it, but I question whether or not even that is if that is even true, that it is this gradual ladder that you're climbing to something. Because I don't have experiences like I used to have, not even remotely. I mean, my life was a three-ring circus. So
it might not be a gradual climb to anything. It might be a bunch of circumstances that you have the choice to not fuck up again.
Maybe.
And they just keep recurring in different themes or different visages.
Well,
until you finally, like you did in that hall,
right?
You stand up and say what you believe.
Right. Well, I mean, for me, I mean, anytime I've ever been, you know, if I
get asked on another show or I'm at a conference and somebody, the question they always ask me is, so what do you take away from all this? Like, where, what has it gotten you? Like, is there a prize at all yet? And I said, well, my only prize is that before my life, before I entered into this and the pursuit or the engagement of it, was pretty much things are what they are. And you do what you've got to do to be a human being living a life. And now that has changed because if nothing else, this says to me, there's more to life than what you've been led to believe. Question everything. Question even right down to what you are. I mean, that is where it has put me, is to question everything, to really look deeper than what you just encounter in a daily hypnotic trance-like life, you know? So I do feel somewhat awakened by it in a way, to see deeper into things than I, or to analyze more into things or contemplate life and reality and all of these things much deeper and much bigger and much more grand. And that's what it's done for me. But that's not that I can't say that that was like a free ticket by any stretch. It wasn't no free ticket.
Well, it can't be a free ticket.
No. And can it destroy your life? Yes, it can. But I think you'll get it back. And I think that once you get it back, then maybe there's more. Once you get past the sci-fi and you get past all of that, I think that's where we are right now, which is kind of at the next step of examining it. And it kind of, I mean, and we've had during the course of this show, we've had these weird little responses, at least that we perceive as responses to what we're doing or what we've said or a conversation we've had on the phone or whatever. We've had certain strange things kind of pop in here. Collins, appearance on the show. I mean, that's the one thing that comes to mind the most.
Well, even the fact, you know, how funny is it that then we have on Cynthia Andrews, mm-hmm. and you know, the episode where I was going to talk about the Kogi, and you haven't heard this yet, but she brings up the Kogi in the middle of the episode as an example of something or other. You'll hear it.
Mm.
I don't want to spoil it for you, but it's like, once again, and then it turns out she went to the thing in upstate New York
that
we
really
talk about, and yeah, I mean, it had an experience there.
Mm.
So it's like the small web of life between us and the Andrews.
Yeah,
just spindled out another web.
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, and there's kind of, right down to weird synchronicities that you've had. I mean, with the 11-11 and 10-10 and all of that, like that's not accidental. There's something to that. There's some, and I believe, I mean, as much as you laugh about that and go, by the way, it's 11-11 or something like, I mean, there's something about that.
No, there's that. Definitely no. I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. It's funny you mentioned that because, you know, I looked up at the clock outside and it was like 4:44 or something.
Like, yeah.
I mean, the thing about it is, and I think I said this on the show, that started happening the moment that I made a joke when it was 11:11 or one of those times, 10:10, uh-huh. whatever it was. I made a joke, you know, because you make a wish, and my wish was, I don't want the next minute to ever happen. It was like something like that. I never want the next minute to happen. And
right.
It hasn't.
Right. Yeah. I
honestly think that if I look at a clock 10 times a day, 20 times a day, let's say 10. If I look at a clock 10 times a day, 8 of those 10 times is going to be that type of number, 444555.
Right.
That's beyond chance. I mean, and it's been like that for like the better part of a year, right?
Right.
Or more than a year?
Probably more. I would say more, yeah.
I mean, how that can't be chance, and yet it's nonsensical beyond the cosmic joke of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here's where I'm going to make a little prediction. And anybody can take this for what it's worth. Everybody knows what I do at this point. So for my son's graduation, my dad well, this past Christmas, he gave me a flag, and he said he was going to build me a flagpole. He's got this great flagpole at his house, and I wanted one, and so he made me one. And every day since I've got it, you know, I go out in the morning, I put the flag up. Every night when I come home, I take it down. And every time I take it down, I look straight up, And if you know me, you know I don't look up a lot at a night sky very much. Like I'll look, you know, 40 degrees off the horizon, but I won't look directly overhead. I rarely do that. And every night when I go to take that flag down, I think to myself, you know, you're going to look up there one day and something's going to be hovering right up there. Now, I have thought this for at least the past 2 weeks. I have thought, you know, you're going to look up there one day and you're going to see something moving. And so every night I go out with my camera. And so I'll bet you within the next couple of months that it might not be a great picture, but I bet you I have a picture or something. I'll bet you.
I was going to say it'll happen the time you don't go out there with your camera.
Exactly. Or that. You know, and I'll be 100% upfront. You know, if I get anything visually, I'm not going to touch it. I'm going to send it to Maccabee, or I'll send it to anybody who wants to see it, who wants to pick it over. I don't want anything to do with it. I'm telling you, the thought doesn't even have to. It's not even a conscious thing. Like I look up as the flag's coming down and make sure that the rope is not getting caught on the pulley, because we had that problem. And so I'm always looking. Am I pulling it the right way? And when I look up, I'm looking dead into almost black sky. And I think one of these days, man, I'm going to look up there and there's going to be something there. And I don't even know that I'm consciously going out there with the aspect of thinking, yeah, when I look up, I might see something. It doesn't happen until I look up and I'm pulling the flag down that I think that thought pops into my head. And I'll bet you, I'm telling you, as weird as it sounds, I'll bet you that I end up seeing something, or I end up getting some kind of either bad shot of it or a good shot, maybe. I don't know. But I'm just making that.
It's coming.
I'm making that point because every night I do it, and every night the same thought pops into my head. So if that's how it works and that's how this back and forth goes, it'll either make a liar out of me or it'll acquiesce and something will be there. So we'll see. I don't know. Maybe it might be nothing, but I'm just saying the thought keeps popping into my head.
Well, I look forward to that.
We'll see.
All right, Jeff. Anything else before we skedaddle?
Nope.
Very good. Dr. Andrews, thank you again for coming on the show.
Yes, I am very sorry I didn't make it, Cynthia. I hope you'll come back and we'll all be here.
Back. In fact, she threw out the seed of doing a show with Colin that he would get a kick out of that.
So excellent.
That'll be great.
We'll put
the wheels in motion on that. Her book, again, is The Path of Energy, and you can get this any which way you wish, your local bookstore, Amazon, whatever. All right, Jeff, thank you for – this is actually good because we have a bunch of new subscribers now, and so it's kind of like they've got a primer on your stuff with added depth questions.
So we'll be having a lot of unsubscribers is what you're saying.
No, come on. People love the Jeff Furtzman stories. All right. Sweet dreams, everybody. I'm going to go turn on my air conditioner.
Great. Good night, all.